It's cloudy and cool, 30% chance of afternoon rain, a high of 46. Now 44 Kenosha, 43 Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And on today's morning show, I am very, very excited to be able to speak about one of the most important topics that is confronting the human race right now, namely climate change. And I'm speaking with someone who is coming to the area to speak on that very topic at a big event at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, hosted and sponsored by the College of Natural and Health Sciences. It's the CNHS Annual Alumni and Community Celebration this coming Saturday, November 2nd, in the UW Parkside Student Center Ballroom. And it's a big event, a fundraiser for the scholarships for the College of Natural and Health Sciences, and it will, among other things, include two different panel discussions, and one of them on environmental challenges of the 21st century. And one of the panelists being brought in for that particular part of the event is Dr. Ankur Desai, who is Director of Graduate Studies and Associate Chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and Reed Bryan Professor of Climate, People, and Environment. And Professor Desai has been working tirelessly in this very important field of study for many, many years. And I'm very excited to be able to have a few minutes with him on the telephone to talk about his work and about this important topic, and to get from him some thoughts on how we can more thoughtfully consider the reality of climate change and its impact on our planet and on our lives. Dr. Ankur Desai, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me, Greg. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
I'm pleased that we can have this conversation. I would love to know ahead of our conversation a little bit about who you are, in a sense, where you come from, and what has been kind of behind your attraction to this particular topic and an academic endeavor.
Absolutely. So I grew up in the East Coast of the United States in New Jersey, where I spent a lot of my formative years in the outdoors and in nature. You might tend to think of New Jersey as a pretty industrial place, but it actually has some pretty amazing environments in the Pine Barrens and the coastal marshes. I spent a lot of my time actually through Boy Scouts and things like that, spending my time outdoors. At the same time, I was also a computer nerd kid. And when I got to college, it was an opportunity, as I joined an environmental studies type major, to really combine both my passion in understanding the world through nature and also understanding the world through emerging technologies and computers. Over the years, I went through graduate school and had a number of jobs here or there, and I joined University of Wisconsin-Madison as a faculty member here in the Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences Department in the year 2007. The department here is a storied department. It has a long history. It goes all the way back to the late 1940s, one of the first major atmospheric science programs in the country. where people over the years have focused on questions about, you know, the things that we normally think of in meteorology, like weather systems and extreme weather and forecasting, but also key advances both in being able to do long-term observations of weather and climate, particularly from satellites. We are the inventor of the weather satellite here in this building that I'm at in Madison, as well as in understanding climate, and especially with the creation of the Center for Climatic Research and then eventually the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. A number of researchers have come here over the years to really focus on understanding broadly the atmosphere, the ocean, the land, the ice, and the people that all together make our climate and the climate system do what it does.
I want to ask you two what might seem like kind of ridiculously obvious questions, but I think they're really important and they speak to kind of the nature of your academic field. You are the associate chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and it probably says a whole lot that the words atmospheric and oceanic are grouped together as they are in this particular academic discipline. Explain that connection. I mean, I'm afraid briefly, I'm sure we could probably spend 45 minutes just talking about that, but how those two things, in a sense, cannot be understood apart from the other.
Yeah, and we often get jokes about it here, of course, because here we are in the Midwest, relatively far from a saltwater ocean. And we're like, well, why do we have an oceanic sciences department at the University of Wisconsin? And one of the things I try to explain or try to make clear is that if we want to understand how weather and climate operate and how they impact people and society, you can't understand that system without the ocean, right? We have this planet that's nearly three-quarters of the covered by ocean. Water can absorb a lot of heat. It circulates and moves, and so it moves that heat around. And what weather and climate really is kind of the science of how that heat is moved around by this fluid that envelopes us that we call the atmosphere. And so what happens in the ocean strongly affects weather and climate just about everywhere. A good example of that, for example, would be El Nino, which is this every 3 to 5 year warming of the tropical Pacific Ocean. And amazingly, that small change in the tropical Pacific Ocean temperatures has implications for weather systems in the North Pacific, which then influences things like how whether or not we have a warm or average winter in Wisconsin. And so when we train our students, we train them broadly to think both about the atmosphere and the ocean at the same time. And I suppose if we wanted to play the name inflation game, we could also throw in ice and land and people, which are also important in their own ways. But I think for the from first order, just understanding the atmosphere and ocean is a key part of understanding climate.
You are also the Reed Bryan Professor of Climate, People, and Environment.
Yeah.
And I'm really intrigued by that. I suspect that's a relatively new thing to have a to have those three terms grouped together to represent an academic department. Tell us what is behind that grouping.
Sure. And what may surprise you or your listeners is that, you know, thinking about the intersection of climate, environment, and people actually goes way back. Some of the early papers on climate change, for example, and how people are influencing climate go all the way back to the middle of the 19th century. Here at the University of Wisconsin, this program, the name of this professorship, the Reed Bryson Climate Professorship of Climate, Environment, and People, came about through a gift to the Center for Climatic Research and the Nelson Institute more than a decade ago. And the goal of that program is really to help build connections across campus for people who think more, say, in the physical climate system, or people who think more about ecology and environmental systems and land use, and then people who think about how people are intersecting with that. To give some backstory on the name, so Reed Bryson was a faculty member here. He was one of the founding members of our department of Atmospheric Oceanic Sciences and the founder of the Center for Climatic Research and the Nelson Institute. And during his time here in the 60s and 70s, and into the 80s, he pioneered a lot of the science of really understanding the role of humans' influence on climate. And some of the early papers that he wrote in the 1970s were highly influential in kind of fostering additional thought on how we could better understand the role of people on climate. His later career, he focused more on really looking at archaeological evidence for some of this. It was really kind of a very broad thinker who worked. He didn't really pigeonhole himself into a certain field, but he really tried to intersect and bring together people from different locations. And that's something that I like to do as well. So it's a big honor for me to have this professorship, which I was awarded last year. It's one that we tend to hold for a period of time, and then we try to award mid-career and faculty who are doing work exactly in that area. It allows me to run a seminar series, which brings together a variety of researchers across the country who give talks here at the university and meet with faculty. And it allows me to pursue some interesting ideas, particularly on how we can understand everything from the role of agriculture on local water use to the role of global forestry on carbon dioxide emissions.
How much of what you study and teach is taken up with this threat of climate change? I mean, does that, in a sense, predominate nearly everything that you do and explore as a department?
Yes and no. I think as a department, we are fundamentally focused on the basics of how climate and weather work. And it's very hard to look at anything today in our field without thinking about how human-caused climate change currently and into the future changes those factors. So it certainly shows up in a lot of places all the time, and we would not be doing our jobs if we didn't train our undergraduate and graduate students to think about climate change, both past, present, and future, and how that influences the work that they're going to be doing, whether that's weather forecasting, whether that's consulting with an insurance company on flood risk management, whether that's something that is more focused on day-to-day operations of our field. In my work, broadly, I look at the role of ecosystems and landscapes and how climate and climate change influence those and vice versa. So we also look at how things like changes in ecosystems and land use actually influence the climate. And that work is certainly strongly motivated by climate change, but it's not the only thing that we look at. We're also just interested in the basics of plant physiology, the basis of how climate and greenhouse gases shape what we see today on the land. In terms of the courses I teach and the courses we teach in the department, we do see a lot of interest and demand, especially among our undergraduate students here at UW-Madison, in generally the topics of sustainability and climate change. We're not the only department on campus that addresses this topic. There are certainly other departments that do a much better job focusing on things like the environmental economics of climate or risk management, for example, where I recently gave a talk in the business school. I do teach an undergraduate class called Global Change. My colleague, Professor Matt Hitchman, and I alternate teaching that. And this is a course that is focused on getting students to think broadly, not so much as much about the science, but really about how you integrate the science with what they see every day in the news and what they might be doing in their future careers. So most of the students are not science majors. It's a writing-intensive class, so we focus a lot on really just, say, reading what's in the news or looking at campaign speeches of political candidates or looking at how to find something on the web when you can easily be led astray by very slickly produced websites from, you know, different political or partisan organizations. So it's a really fun class that I really enjoy teaching every year. Some of my more advanced classes, we generally also look at the basis of how climate operates. We have an advanced undergraduate class where we actually have students running a desktop computer version of a climate model that usually requires a supercomputer to run. And they can actually in real time plot graphics of how climate is changing based on the parameters, and they can do everything like turn the Earth upside down if they wanted to. And that really gives them a good feel for how exactly we use computer models, which are a really important part of our science, to make sense of the world.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Ankur Desai. He is a director of graduate studies and associate chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison and the Reed Bryan Professor of Climate, People, and Environment. We are hearing a lot lately about increasing numbers of young people who seem to have an urgent concern about climate change, and understandably so. And I suspect that maybe has some bearing on the number of students who come into your department really interested right from the start. Is that kind of oversimplifying the situation, or do you find that, in fact, there are a lot of young people not only interested in this, but interested to the point of wanting to study about this?
Yes, there are definitely a growing number of recent high school graduates coming into college with a strong interest in wanting to understand how they can do something about climate change, or as I like to teach my undergraduate class, no matter what their career is going to be, there's going to be some aspect of climates or sustainability or ecosystems that's going to influence just about everything from agriculture to business to global trade to finance to insurance to engineering. And so for a lot of these students coming in, there's a lot of interest in saying, well, my generation is going to be the one that is most likely to be impacted, or certainly my children are the one who will be most likely impacted, and I need to get on top of this. I need to do something about it. What might surprise some of your listeners, though, is it's actually not so much that our young people today are that different. There is quite a bit of concern about the harmful effects of human-caused climate change into the 21st century by all sorts of people. And survey after survey has shown that this is increasing, especially as we start to see some of these more devastating extreme weather, forest fires, hurricanes, et cetera, that have some component of them that are made worse because of climate change. The public is increasingly concerned, and a majority of people are accepting of the science of climate change and are want to see some action on this. Vast majorities of Wisconsin residents, based on recent surveys done by the Pew Center, are interested in seeing policy being enacted that helps reduce the harmful effects of climate change and helps mitigate our fossil fuel emissions in a way that limits future climate change. So there's a lot of action, not just from young people, but from people of all ages. And there's a lot of interest. Probably the biggest barrier to this is so much that we all have a lot of concern, but many of us are not in day-to-day talking about this or hearing about it as much on the news or really worried about what their neighbors and others might be thinking about this topic, when in reality most of them are kind of on the same page on this.
I think this is probably as good a point as any to kind of talk about what, at least in general, the science community believes is going on with our planet in terms of what we're now calling climate change. I'd be really interested, first of all, to know, in a sense, how long the community of scientists, that's kind of an interesting way to put it, but I think you know what I mean, the scientific community, how long this concern has been trumpeted. And the shift that seems to happen, at least in terms of the shorthand by which we talk about this, that once upon a time it seems like the term that was being used to describe this was global warming. And now we seem to have migrated to the term climate change. And I'd also be curious to know at what point in time that shift occurred, if indeed I'm correct in characterizing it as that.
Yeah, and there has been some changes in terminology. Some of that is more driven by the media than by science. But yeah, let me answer the first part of your question, which is about kind of the history of climate change science and where this has come to. I try to not characterize necessarily things on the idea of belief per se, but when we say belief or consensus, what we really mean in science, which is how we do all of our science in every field, is that we tend to come to accept things to be what they are based on once accumulated evidence has become so rich and varied from multiple different angles and multiple different fields, and there are no compelling alternative hypotheses or explanations that does anywhere near good a job. And that's where we are today with climate change, which, when I mentioned earlier, goes all the way back to the mid-19th century in some of the early foundational papers that really set aside that, yes, greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide are a driver of changes in climate or the average of weather across long time periods, that greenhouse gases are changing because of fossil fuel emissions, and that fossil fuel emissions are likely to continue and accelerate into the 20th century, and any potential stopgaps on that because of land or ocean taking up some amount of that CO2 is likely to not is not going to override this continued effect. A lot of this really ramped up into the 1950s when we had some large experiments set up to really understand the role of greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and methane and nitrous oxide in the atmosphere. And the first U.S. report that where it basically said climate change will likely have deleterious effects on society and that there should be consideration of how we might mitigate that goes all the way back to a report from President Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s.
Wow.
And continues into the 1970s with a variety of studies that were set up by the World Meteorological Organization. And these were the precursor to the reports that were officially set up in the 1980s with the signing of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is a global treaty that the U.S. is a signatory to, as well as most countries of the world, that, yes, we care about climate change, we should do something about it, and we should continue studying it. Those reports come out every 4 to 5 years, and these are volunteer scientists, nearly 1,000 or more, who get together. They run 2 dozen or so competing climate models that have all the same basic physics of how climate works, because it's really just fluid Newton's laws and the laws of thermodynamics. There's nothing all that new in the actual equations of climate science, and try to compare and contrast how these things change over space and time. This has been going on since the 80s, and every 4 to 5 years, these reports get more solidified, more evidence accumulates, and so now there's basically complete certainty, or 99.99 plus percent certainty, that climate change is occurring, it's accelerating, it's driven by fossil fuel emissions of greenhouse gases, and this is likely to continue to a point where sometime in the mid-21st century, without significant measures in mitigation or adaptation, the net negative effects of climate change will start to outweigh any potential positive benefits that could occur in places. The terminology is an interesting story, and some of that has to go with how the public reporting on this. I think the term global warming, which really caught on in the 1980s and into the 1990s, was a nice shorthand for describing the big picture view of climate. And at the time, the climate models and the projections we had of future climate, we're doing a really good job of picking out, yes, the whole globe on average warms, and we see these effects globally. And it was a little harder to tell apart what was happening, say, in Wisconsin versus Ohio, for example, really picking apart some of the more regional effects. As that science has improved, the science of regional climate change impacts, we've started to see a lot of maybe a shift in terminology a bit to climate change, partly because it does a better job of being more inclusive of all the things that happen locally as a result of the globe as a whole warming, which can include, in some places, short-term periods of cooling or periods of more affecting precipitation. Or, say, in Wisconsin, it's more about winter warming, which is really about Wisconsin becoming less cold. So I think the term climate change just does a better job of explaining the changes. And there's a whole variety of these terminologies that people have come across, like global weirding or climate crisis. And I, you know, as a scientist, I'm not too wedded in the specific words that people use. I'm interested in the evidence and what it says about how the world is changing and what options we have in the future to prevent the harmful effects.
I was thinking we would wait till the end of our conversation to talk a little bit about climate change skeptics, but actually I find myself prompted to kind of launch in right now and have you speak to some of the concerns that have been raised by such skeptics. And maybe right off the bat, we need to acknowledge the fact that at least some of that semi-official skepticism is coming from scientists, and maybe I should even put that term in quotes, that in a sense are working on behalf of industries that are very much tied up in the whole matter of climate change. And this is probably an important thing to understand and acknowledge when we're talking about where climate change skeptics are coming from, or at least some of them. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, so I'd be happy to. And it's something we actually look at in the classroom, where I have students just type into Google things like global warming hoax and let them figure out, well, what is the evidence that's being presented, and are they making legitimate claims, and how does that compare to what we broadly call the consensus science? And let students actually make up their own mind, because there is a role for skepticism in science. It's fundamentally what we do, which is try to falsify hypotheses about nature. What we see happening with climate change, of course, is that this is, of course, also embroiled with potential political or business or cultural changes that strongly either put businesses or society into a different trajectory, or potentially put some industries at a significant disadvantage. And as a result, there is a relatively orchestrated industry of people who are prone, I would broadly call professional deniers, who are not so much interested in debating the science, but really using, you know, some level of uncertainty in science, because science always has uncertainty, to prevent future regulation at the governmental level of fossil fuels or fossil fuel emissions. This is a hard place. I'm not a political scientist, and I'm not one who spends day-to-day thinking a lot about how that works, but it does make our job a little bit harder, because I'm interested in broadly presenting the information and letting people come to their own conclusions. What's interesting is that population of people who are, even call themselves scientists, who are primarily working on finding holes in our discipline, is a pretty small number of people. We're talking single-digit percentage or less. And it's true that every once in a while in science we have a radical or a heretic or somebody who really just changes a whole field overnight. Those stories tend to be a little bit apocryphal in that they're not really how things work. It really takes mountains of accumulated evidence. Yes, we all love when we look at do an experiment and something just seems out of whack, and we say, huh, right? Huh is actually more important than eureka in science. You know, that's weird. But that case has not been made for climate change. What's instead been made is, what's been weird is like, huh, CO2 keeps rising, fossil fuels keep going up, and the ocean and land sinks that take up carbon don't keep up. And every single time we look at this from every single different type of record, it's clear that climate is strongly sensitive to carbon dioxide, and carbon dioxide is driven by fossil fuel emissions. And if we don't have ways, which could be free market or government or somewhere in between, ways to reduce emissions, we will likely find ourselves in having to pay a lot more to clean up the mess later. What we see in some of this climate skepticism is really, there's a little bit of a gulf between the public and science, right? There's very, very few climate scientists who would say, and in fact, if you talk to some of the most kind of credentialed atmospheric science skeptics of global warming, climate change, most of them have moved the goalposts a bit. A lot of them accept observations because they're good scientists, many of them, and so they see, yes, the observations now support what they see. Warming is happening. The science and the theories do support carbon dioxide as a driver. They may have different opinions about whether we should focus more on mitigation or adaptation, or whether we should focus more on emissions reduction today or 50 years from now. But those are mostly questions about policy and economics and not so much about the science. Among the public, I think there's a sense that scientists are more disagreeing than they actually are, and that does sometimes limit the debate. But I think in my day-to-day work, when I work with industry leaders, when I work, for example, in my role as a trustee of the Wisconsin Nature Conservancy with folks in business and so forth, when I chat with folks who are interested in learning more about this, there's generally most people are on this page of, yes, we need to take care of this. They may have differing opinions of how to go about this. And it's rarely about the science that really is where the argument is laid. And there's really great resources. There's a great website called Skeptical Science that really just answers every single one of those little niggling questions about the sun or the orbits or volcanoes or that have been well disputed but now been disproved as the drivers of climate change, well explained for the public online.
No small matter, is it, to try to kind of put this in terms that the public can grasp and yet not oversimplify complicated matters. I don't envy anybody who is trusted with that task.
Well, it's hard because I do worry, like when I give talks to the public and even when I teach my undergraduate climate change, I have to often start like, look, some of this material may make you feel depressed or angry or fearful. And a natural response to that may be, I don't want to think about this, or I don't want to deal with this, or I'm really looking for somebody to tell me that this is all a big hoax or conspiracy, and I'm going to go with that. Like, and as well as a response on the other side, like, oh, no, the world is going to end in 12 years. Spoiler alert, it's not, most likely. So it's, you know, that response, that fear, that emotional response to scientific information that's threatening to your livelihood, to your culture, to your way of life, can spurn both types of reaction among people. And I have to think very carefully when I give talks to the public, in addition to kind of making clear the science, really being open to understanding that this is an issue that will lead to emotional reaction and that there is some psychology to how people react to these types of things, and that fear is a natural response, and it can drive both strong denial of it as well as excessive alarm about it.
I want to ask you about a couple of different points that I have heard raised. And the first point in terms of skepticism actually raised by a colleague of mine. I don't want to say much more than that. I won't even say a colleague at this particular place where I work, because there's several. So I'll just say a colleague who's a very intelligent person, by the way, and well-read. His skepticism about climate change stems from the fact that we have this huge human history, and planetary history, I guess, is even more significant, that stretches back so far. And yet, in terms of the amount of hard and fast information we have, that by and large is very, very recent. And given that reality, there is no way that we can have that kind of supreme overview understanding of exactly what is happening and why, and that this could be just a little bump in the road in this sort of immense span of our planet's history. I find that an intriguing argument. And I'm sort of at a loss at how to respond to that kind of skepticism, which I think is, it's an intriguing point, I think, that that they are raising. What would your response be to that?
Well, I mean, I think there's something fair to part of that comment, which is that it is true. We do put ourselves a hubris if we claim to know how everything works all the time and that, you know, science will always tell us if you do X, Y will happen. However, this is something where climate scientists have actually spent quite a bit of time, including the namesake of my professorship, Reed Bryson, and people like John Kutzbach here at the University of Wisconsin, who's now retired, and others, which is really trying to place into context what's happening today with past, using a variety of really amazing techniques like digging 2-mile deep holes into the Antarctic ice core, looking at thousand-year-old dead trees, looking at cave and fossil records, and really starting to connect the history of Earth to the history of humans on Earth. And there's a couple of things we've learned from those studies. One is, yes, there have been these 40,000 and 20,000 and even thousand-year timescale changes in climate that drive things like ice ages and periods of warmth, We've also learned that the last time we had CO2 going to where we are in the 21st century, we had sea level that was tens of meters higher. We had tropical forests into the mid-latitudes. You're talking about climates of tens of millions of years ago. And that CO2 today is higher than anything we've seen in the last 1 million years. So there's a lot that actually the history gives us a lot of reason to actually be concerned about what we're doing. The rate of change is unprecedented. We have near certainty that it's fossil fuels because we can actually measure the radiocarbon of air, which is like, you know, if you've heard of carbon dating to like see how old some ancient mummy or something is, we can do the same thing with air. And it's very clear from the fact that the radiocarbon content of the atmosphere is decreasing even after nuclear testing, which adds radiocarbon to the atmosphere, that the atmosphere is primarily the CO2 in the air is primarily from fossil fuels, which are 60 million year old dead plants primarily. So the history that we have actually gives us a lot more information and a lot more confidence that what we're seeing today is unusual, driven by humans, and that future climates are ones that humans have not experienced. The interesting thing too, if you look at just the last 1,000 years, broadly what we call in geology, the Holocene, it's actually been a period of excessively stable climate, or not excessively is the wrong word, but a very stable climate. And this is coincident with a period of expansion of humans into areas where they formed agricultural agrarian societies and formed civilizations, which were very dependent on having predictable and stable climates. And while we've had technology today that allows us to become more resilient to changes in climate, more resilient to extreme weather and things like that than past societies, we still are dependent on a relatively stable climate to do the things we do today in terms of feeding and feeding the world and keeping what we do going. So a lot of concern, too, also comes from more recent past in that we know that when climates have changed in the past, in small blips that are a fraction of what we're likely to see in the 21st century, that human societies have been broadly disrupted. And that's occurred in Europe, that occurred in Asia, occurred in the Middle East, in all sorts of early societies. And there's no reason to say, well, some things today are actually maybe more vulnerable. We have 7 billion people in the world. That's likely to continue to increase to at least 9 billion by 2050. That's a lot of people. And it's true, once upon a time when the world had less than a billion people, it's very easy to imagine that humans are really just one of many species on the planet. They probably don't have as much change in the world. Today, almost 40% of all of the photosynthesis that occurs on Earth is going into crops, right? It's amazing how much 7 billion people can really be the dominant species changing how the planet operates, and this is why many geologists call this era no longer the Holocene, but actually the Anthropocene, in that what you most see in the geologic record is not the standard geologic processes of sedimentation and fossils and so forth, but really the human imprint on the globe everywhere.
In all facets of human existence. Another point of skepticism that I have heard raised is the fact that that in a sense, all of this concern springs out of a different kind of hubris, namely that we imagine that we as human beings can affect something as immense as our planet and its atmosphere in this way, that essentially the Earth is so much bigger than we are, and how can human activity possibly have the impact that we assume that it does? Which is an intriguing argument, but one I do not find very persuasive. But what would your answer be to someone who says that we're just not big enough to have this kind of impact on a planetary scale, no matter how many human beings there are or what we do?
Well, the first thing I would do is tell them to go to a website on NASA that's called Earth at Night. And there's these really cool satellites that have been flying over space for the last few decades that can actually image the Earth at night. And one of the things you see in that is primarily the lights of civilization, right? You see energy, you see street lights, you see roads, you see large urban conglomerations. And as much as we tend to think of individual human settlements and our individual day-to-day thing as my one little thing I do, when you add it all up and you think about how much of this world we rely on energy to make do what we do, from transportation to agriculture to heating and cooling, it's amazing. It's amazing to me, too, when you look at some of these graphs of so-called global acceleration in the 21st century, right? We've gone from a few billion people to 7 billion people in a century. And to do that, we'd have to grow. We grew the economy by more than 20 to 40 fold. And the quality of life that we have today is partly a factor of that. Often when I teach my undergrads in global change, I say, you know, we start by looking at, you know, what were the advances that allowed humans to really flourish in the 20th century. And we look at everything from internal combustion to refrigeration to variety, you know, to the role of vaccinations and public health and reductions in maternal mortality and the flourishing of civil rights and the role of women in education and decrease in maternal mortality. But all of these things are good things, but they were big things. And we spent a lot of time and money, and they have affected the planet. And when you look at the rate of species extinctions, when you look at the amount of the fact that we every year add 40 billion tons of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, so that it's increased nearly 40% since the Industrial Revolution, it's very hard for me, and I think it's as much a generational thing as anything. We've lived in this period of immense change, and depending on when you grew up, you had a different perspective of the role of humans in the world. I don't think any recent college graduate today would have that same level of skepticism, because it's very clear to them just how much humans have changed the planet.
Right. And I think you're right that when one just looks at an image of the planet Earth and gets a sense of just how thin that atmosphere is that clings tightly to the Earth, it becomes very clear that that yes, we indeed can have an impact on that atmosphere, mm-hmm. and that changes essentially everything. I should think that as we are living our lives and digesting the news, that you would have us be careful of jumping to assumptions that this tornado or that wildfire or this drought can be directly attributed to climate change. And yet it would seem to be unmistakable to scientists that these kind of events that we do see all the time in the news are tied somehow to climate change. How would you have us understand those instances when it kind of seems like the climate is broken, as I've heard some people say? I mean, are we being simplistic when we tie climate change to the weather that we see around us?
Yes and no. So the short answer is, the question of did climate change cause X, a hurricane or a severe weather event, is not a good question, right? Because climate is the science of statistics. And weather is about what actually happens, right? Climate is what you expect, and weather is what you get, is a famous quote attributed to a number of people, so we don't know who said it first. And another good analogy, right, the question we want to ask is not so much did climate change cause this event, but is this event in some way different because the climate is different today? Is it stronger? Is it more frequent? Is it of a different scale or scope? And that, in general, for a lot of cases, especially for tropical cyclones, we have really good evidence that the answer for that is yes, because the temperature of the ocean drives just about everything in that case. The answer is yes, with the caveat that land management also influences for things like increasing western wildfires. So some of that is from long-term history of fire suppression, but an equal amount of that is also from warmer, drier summers. A good analogy I like is actually baseball themes, right? So think about batting averages, right, which tell you the percentage of times a batter hits. And batting averages are a statistic, kind of the way climate is, an average. And the question is, if you saw a individual batter, say, starting to have a home run streak or something like that, and over time their batting average went up, now, you might say, well, maybe that's just natural variability or something. But say it kept doing that, and say you had some evidence that, like, everybody who, say, used some steroid or something like that had their batting average go up. You wouldn't say that every time they go up to bat now, they're going to hit a home run, right? Their batting average is not one. Their batting average might be 0.4 or something like that, or 0.3. But you do know that because of this change in the batting average, because of something they did, like taking a drug in that case, or maybe increases the likelihood that you're going to hit, right? And that actually bears out in baseball statistics. And the same is true about, does climate change make weather events more extreme? Yes, but it's really about the statistics. You're more likely to have X. A good example of that would be extreme rainfall in Wisconsin. It's not unusual in, say, spring to have a thunderstorm dump a few inches of rain in a short period of time, causing a lot of us to run to our basements to go bail it out. But when it becomes a thing that happens more regularly or every year or more frequently, it changes. That is because climate change is accelerating the water cycle, and that allows for extreme precipitation to increase in magnitude. And over time, if we have more and more of those events, it's not so much a big deal that you have to go bail out your basement more and more, but the big deal is really about this changes how cities have to deal with flood management. This deals with problems in accessing fields for harvest time. This deals with problems of combined sewer and water outflow and how that influences the health of the Great Lakes. And each one of those, right, isn't so much affected by the single extreme storm, but how frequent and how often they happen. And that's really where the question has to be, how much is climate change a contributor to this, and how much can either mitigation and reduction of the harmful effects by reducing emissions help reduce this, and how much do we have to kind of get used to this because we're not going to necessarily get rid of all of the worst effects, and what are the things that we invest in today to reduce the effects of, say, extreme rainfall-driven flooding on society.
Hmm. In our last minute, I know you are probably pleased that Governor Tony Evers has issued an executive order to create a climate change task force. Tell us what you know about that.
Yeah, so like many of you, I heard this on the news a few days ago. That this task force on climate change is going to be developed as part of one of two executive orders that were signed. There was an earlier one that also created an Office of Sustainability and Clean Energy with a goal of figuring out how can Wisconsin become carbon-free by 2050 and reduce its emissions. This newest executive order helps revive some things that were already happening in Wisconsin. Earlier, we had something known as the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. It brought together business and industry, state government agencies, university scientists, and stakeholders in nonprofit sector and elsewhere together in a variety of working groups to look at how does Wisconsin respond to the changing climate and what is it that we actually see here in our backyard. This is really exciting to help rebuild that effort, which languished over the years afterwards, after 2011. And try to come back to the table, which I think is very much in the spirit of the Wisconsin idea, that we are people who bring together folks from all walks of life to sit down and say, what are the practical things that we'll need to be dealing with here in Wisconsin? Because regardless of where your thoughts are on global climate change, I think just about everybody in the state cares a lot about having a healthy and clean environment. They care about it when they worry about the quality of their lakes that they recreate in. They worry about it when they worry about the quality of water that they're drinking out of their tap. And all of these things can be linked to some level to issues around climate change. So I think this is going to be a net good in terms of really building together community and buy-in on how we can address and to update that report, in particular the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts Report, or WICI as it's called. And really look at practical solutions for how Wisconsin in particular can both adapt and potentially mitigate the effects of climate change.
Hmm. Dr. Ankur Desai, a faculty member at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, speaking at UW Parkside on November 2nd for the College of Natural and Health Sciences annual alumni and community celebration. And you can get more information at uwp.edu. Dr. Desai, thank you so much for being a part of the morning show today, and thank you for being part of this important conversation. Best wishes.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on the morning show, you'll hear the conversation which I have recorded with Nancy Tate, co-chair of the 2020 Women's Vote Centennial Initiative, and before that, executive director of the League of Women Voters of the United States. Nancy Tate is coming to Carthage as a Woodrow Wilson visiting fellow, and she will be interviewed, actually, tomorrow, Tuesday, 6 p.m., by Carthage faculty member Dr. Stephanie Mitchell. In my conversation with Nancy Tate, we explore the long history of the long struggle for women in the United States to gain the right to vote, a right which was finally and completely granted with the ratification of the 19th Amendment. So you hear my conversation with Nancy Tate on tomorrow.